The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. To discuss these very things and more, Gayle King sat down with actor and talk show host Drew Barrymore, co-host of The Bachelorette, Tashia Adams, and dating experts Matthew Hussey and Logan Urie. Each of them has a distinct perspective on what it takes to find love nowadays. Keep reading for a preview of their talk, then head to oprahdaily.com/dating-roundtable to view the entire conversation. Finding the One. Gayle. Matthew, you're recently engaged. How did you know your fiancé was the one? Matthew. It was the first time I didn't need to go and ask my friends' opinions. Asking my friends and family was always the sign that I was unsure. This was the first time I needed that validation. I was just excited to inform everyone that I had found my person. It's hard to date. Gayle. Logan, I want to start with you. In the past, you've said something that really resonated with me. You said love is natural, but dating is not. Why is dating so hard? Logan. We are born knowing how to love. Anyone who has a kid knows this. So loving is not a new skill, but dating is. Dating started around 1890, and dating apps are only about 10 years old. As for why dating is so hard right now, one reason is that we have so many options. There's an overwhelming sense of choice. Gayle. Drew, you're a household name. You walk down the street and people know you. Do you think dating is hard? Drew. I never think I'm anybody when I walk down the street. I'm just as much of a romantic as anybody else. I'm in the phase of being a woman who has kids and isn't looking to get married. I've looked at dating through several lenses in my life. I think that dating differs depending on where you are at and what you are looking for. Gayle. Tashia, what about you? Tashia. I think dating is very hard. Hi, I dated 20 guys at once. It's hard. I know what I offer, I know what I deserve, and I agree with you, Drew. It depends where you are in life to really decipher if dating is hard or not. But I'm sorry, I don't want to go on a million dates to find my guy. Putting yourself out there. Gayle. Drew, you recently did something that I thought was so bold. Will you share what you did? Drew. I was in Central Park and I saw a man I found attractive. I followed him and I just went in and said, "Excuse me, I'm so sorry to bother you, but I saw you and I felt compelled to come up and ask you a question. Are you single?" He said, "Perhaps." To which I said, "Are you gay?" I only asked because I tend to be the wrong tree. He wasn't. I was so shy. I was also wearing a full mask, so I pulled it off and told him it was nice to meet him and we got to talking. Matthew. I absolutely love it. We go through life killing our chances by overthinking everything we do. And the fact that Drew did something instead of nothing, it's wonderful. Let's talk about the spark. Gayle. Logan, you say that even if the first date wasn't great, you should consider a second. Why? Logan. We've been trained to think the first date should be instant fireworks. I've had clients who say they had a great time, the conversation was good, but they're not going to see that person again because they didn't feel a spark. We've become obsessed with the spark. But some of the best people in my life, the most strong, the most compassionate, the most loyal, are not sparky people. Who do you want on your team? Do you want the superstar? No. My husband is such a good partner for me, but he's an introverted scientist. He's not the sparkiest person. Drew. I agree. I think the hardest part about dating for me is how virtual it has become. I don't have to be brave anymore, and it has really screwed us up. I find the behavior of people in the dating app world to be so unaccountable. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. You can have an exchange on an app, and it fizzles into nothing. So even getting to a spark or a slow burn is challenging. Gayle. Tashia, do you look for a spark? Tashia. No. I feel like if it's a spark, it's more lustful, probably a bad boy or someone that's not going to last a long time. So I'm not a spark person. I also hear what Drew is saying. I have girlfriends on dating apps who will be talking to a guy for like 2 months and nothing ever transpires. Drew. One thing I will say is I do think going on a date is fun. The hope, the getting dressed up, and if it doesn't work out, you try again. Never stop believing in the possibilities. Past behavior you've experienced shouldn't be taken out on someone else. Give everyone a clean slate and enjoy dating. Gail, I resonate with everything you just said, Drew. Give everyone the benefit of the doubt until they give you a reason not to. What type of dater are you? Gail, Logan, you say there are three types of dating tendencies. What are they? Logan, the first one is the romanticizer. This person loves love. They think if it feels easy, it must be right. If it feels hard, it must not be. The next type is the maximizer. They are looking for the optimal person. They may be dating someone they like, but wonder if they could find someone 5% more interesting or more attractive. It's a grass is always greener mentality. And then there's the hesitator. This is the person who's not dating at all. They think they'll be more lovable when they lose weight or when they clean their apartment, but the reality is no one is ever fully ready to date. Gail, when you said romanticizer, I definitely thought that was me. Drew, what are you? Drew, I am a hopeful romantic, but I'm also coming to dating for the first time knowing that I am going to be okay. That's a place I've never dated from before. Gail, that's very freeing. Tashia, did any of those types resonate with you? Tashia, I'm like you. I romanticize things, but I'm also practical. I'm not so far in la la land. I've worked hard on myself, and I don't think that I ask for too much. Tashia Adams is a television personality and host. She first appeared as a contestant on The Bachelor before becoming The Bachelorette in 2020. After that, she went on to co-host The Bachelorette. Drew Barrymore is an actor, the host of The Drew Barrymore Show on CBS, and a mom of two little girls. She is also the co-founder of Flower Beauty and Flower Home. In late 2021, she released her book, Rebel Homemaker. Matthew Hussey is a motivational speaker and a dating expert. He has appeared on numerous television shows, including Entertainment Tonight and Today. His book, Get the Guy, is a New York Times bestseller. Logan Urie is a behavioral scientist turned dating coach. She is also the director of relationship science at the dating app Hinge. In 2021, Logan released her book, How to Not Die Alone. Our next article by Pam O'Brien is titled On the Road. More and more women are taking solo road trips. Here's why you should join them, plus how to connect with other travelers on the open road. Whenever she hits the highway in her camper van, Nancy Crowell feels a rush of happiness. It's like I step into my life when I get in my van, says Crowell, 61, of Lopez Island in Washington. That's when I feel most alive. Crowell, who had never camped before buying the van she named Moku, Hawaiian shorthand for spaceship, has traveled more than 20,000 miles on her own since picking up her van in October 2019 from Peace Vans, a company in Seattle that restores, sells, and rents customized camper vans. She once spent 92 consecutive days camping in it. Crowell has driven down the West Coast twice and through Colorado two times. This spring, she's setting off on a journey to Utah. And then there are the regular short trips she takes. Every Sunday, she travels to the mainland of Washington from her remote island home to go mountain biking and camping in the van for a couple of days. Road tripping has saved her soul, Crowell says. I live by myself on a small island with very few people. Most people go on vacation because they want to relax and go somewhere beautiful, but that's my everyday life. I go looking for adventure and connection. Traveling in her van has allowed Crowell to meet interesting people and experience new things, something that helped prevent her from going stir crazy over the past 2 years. Crowell is one of the growing number of women who have discovered the joy of solo travel. In 2021, 40% of women in the U.S. reported traveling or planning to travel on their own, according to the annual State of Travel Insurance, or SOTI, survey from Berkshire Hathaway Travel Protection, which polls American women and men on their travel habits. Searches for the term solo female travel skyrocketed in 2019, according to Google Trends. And solo female travel groups report that more and more women are reaching out to them for information, inspiration, and connection. Kristen Addis, CEO of the women's solo travel website Be My Travel Muse, which has more than 5 million visitors per year, says her data shows that interest in solo travel has gone up hundreds of percent. adds Mar Pages, co-founder of Solo Female Travelers, a women-only tour company and Facebook group. We've seen accelerating growth, especially since 2020. In the past 12 months alone, we've almost doubled in size. While all types of solo travel are on the rise, road trips appear to have a special allure, particularly in the pandemic era. 75% of the female respondents to the SOTI survey reported road tripping last year. There's nothing safer from a social distancing standpoint than traveling in your own vehicle, points out Nikki Vargas, co-founder of Unearth Women, a travel website and information resource, and co-author of Wondrous, the Unearth Women Guide to Traveling Smart, Safe, and Solo. And increasingly, like Crow, women are joining the hashtag van life trend. The hashtag has more than 12 million posts on Instagram, traveling all over the country for fun and adventure in their camper vans. One of the sales are to single women over age 55, says Harley Sittner, the owner of Peace Vans. A lot of them are successful, doctors, lawyers, they own their own businesses. They don't want an RV, they want something smaller that they can travel and feel safe in. Many of these customers have bought Metris vans, a special line created with Mercedes that Peace Vans has customized for camping. The vans, which cost $80,000 to $100,000, are outfitted with a sink, a stove, storage cabinets and drawers, and seating and sleeping for up to four people. The result, says Crowell, is that they feel almost like second homes. I'm very attached to my van, she confides. I don't like to leave it. While these women may be striking out on their own, they're far from lonely. In fact, there are meetups all over the country for solo female travelers. And many Peace Vans customers connect first through social media and then in real life. A true community is formed. Taking the wheel. As rewarding as the physical journey is, many women discover that the emotional journey inspired by solo travel is what really speaks to them. Traveling on your own is incredibly empowering, Vargas says. It instills a sense of confidence and competence. It also gives you an opportunity to reconnect with yourself. As women, we're constantly in this go, go, go mentality of to-do list, she says. One of the incredible things about solo travel is that you temporarily pull yourself out of that position. You take yourself to a beautiful location where you wake up in the morning and the number one question on your mind is, what do I want to do today? Not, what do I have to do today? And there's such freedom in that. It allows you to discover new things about who you are. Doing what she wants, when she wants, is what Jill Murray of San Diego finds most exhilarating about traveling on her own. I love being on the road at 6 in the morning when the sun's coming up and nobody's out there, says Murray, 65, who has visited Oregon, Arizona, and New Mexico with her dog McTwist since getting her Metris van almost 2 years ago. I like the freedom of saying, I've never heard of Mitchell Caverns, what are those? And then going to check them out. It's the joy of having the freedom to make a quick decision like that, as well as the ability to take care of myself. The natural route. A longing to be in nature is also driving the van life acceleration. Consider Jan Liverance, a website designer who lives near Denver and loves to be outdoors. Liverance, 67, used to go tent camping with her ex-husband. More recently, she spent 3 years traveling on and off in a van with a boyfriend. After they split up, she was eager to try van camping on her own. Especially here out west, there are so many remote places that are not anywhere near hotels or restaurants, Liverance explains. If you want to have those experiences, you really have to camp. What she needed, however, was the right type of vehicle. I want as few layers as possible between me and the outdoors, but to still feel safe, Liverance says. And I wanted a van that was manageable for one person. When she read about the Peace Van's Metris, she knew it was the one. I have so much freedom with this van, Liverance says. Some may think it's an escape, but that's not it. It's about being able to go off and engage with people in new places. Visiting out-of-the-way destinations is what attracted Addis of Be My Travel Muse to solo road tripping a few years ago. I do a version of van life with my pickup truck, she says. I put a bed in the back and I have a camp stove that I cook on. Sometimes I'll go on a 3-day trip, other times it's a week and a half. It's been incredible. Until I started doing it, I had no idea there was free camping all over the Southwest. The Bureau of Land Management has free campsites in states like Utah, Nevada, and Arizona. Often it's a matter of turning down a dirt road and you get a campsite on the edge of a canyon, and you might be the only one out there. Unearth Women's Vargas says there's also an environmental benefit to be found. Your footprint is smaller when you take a road trip, she points out. Because of the pandemic, we've seen how the smog over Los Angeles temporarily lifted. And we realize what can happen if we're a little more conscientious about our carbon footprint through travel. I think that's one reason we're seeing a push away from plane travel and in the direction of road trips. From connection to enjoying natural beauty and beyond, one thing is for sure, the road to adventure is ready and waiting for you. Meet people and make friends. When you travel solo, you're never really alone because you become more approachable, says Natasia Yacoub, 34, author of Dame Traveler, Live the Spirit of Adventure. You'd be surprised how many conversations are sparked simply because you're not engaged in conversation with friends or a significant other. It really does open the door to meeting new and interesting people. Here's how to make the connection. Take the initiative. If you're standing in line to visit a landmark, strike up a conversation with the people around you. That's what Liverance does when she wants to hike a remote or difficult trail but doesn't want to take the chance of going alone. And don't be afraid to ask for assistance, urges Murray. If I need help with something, I will introduce myself to another person and say, "Do you have any ideas on how I can approach this?" You'll find that most people are happy to give you a hand. Give yourself a daily goal. Challenge yourself to get out of your comfort zone, says Vargas. For instance, go out to eat alone and look for opportunities to start a conversation with someone in the restaurant. I found when I eat out by myself, people will come up and say hello and then ask me about my trip. They're often eager to help you get to know their city, she adds, and they'll give you tips and suggestions about what to see and do. Join a tour. Sign up for a sightseeing tour, a walking tour, or even a day trip, suggests Yacoub. That's a great way to meet other travelers. Food tours are also fun and give you the chance to sit and chat with other people as you're eating, says Addis. Nothing encourages connection like breaking bread together. And get to know the locals. An overnight stay at an alpaca farm, a vineyard, or an aviation museum are among the unique experiences you can enjoy by downloading the Harvest Host app, free for iPhone and Android. For $99 annual membership fee, you can park for no charge at more than 3,000 locations across the country and meet and talk with the owners. Liverance, a big fan of Harvest Host, recently stayed on an olive oil farm. Our next article by Uzo Njoku is titled The Journey. Feminist activist, scholar, and writer Salamisha Tillit has read and reflected on most of Alice Walker's work, and last year released In Search of the Color Purple, a tribute to the enduring power and influence of the epistolary novel. Here, Tillit considers Walker's just-released Gathering Blossoms Under Fire, the journals of Alice Walker, 1965-2000, and this, the 40th anniversary of the publication of The Color Purple. Sometime in 1980, a 36-year-old Alice Walker posed this question in her journal. My God, what do Black women writers want? Walker's answer was emphatic, as she wrote in her dark blue spiral notebook. We want freedom. Freedom to be ourselves, to write the unwritable, to say the unsayable, to think the unthinkable. Boldly concluding, to dare to engage the world in a conversation it has not had before. As a Black woman writer who has read almost every novel, poem, essay, or short story Walker has ever published, I found this entry in the new book, Gathering Blossoms Under Fire, The Journals of Alice Walker, 1965-2000, remarkable for its ambition and radical honesty. Writing this 3 years before receiving the National Book Award and making history by becoming the first Black woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction for The Color Purple, Walker had envisioned freedom. Personal, professional, and political, that was unimaginable to generations of Black writers and to Black women generally before her. By doing so, she made a new blueprint for herself and for those of us who have turned to her ideas and words as inspiration, even if we did not have access to her innermost thoughts until now. I first read The Color Purple when I was 15 and had an immediate connection with Walker's Black women characters, particularly Celie, Shug, and Sophia. At the time, it wasn't that I identified with their story arcs or the setting of Georgia in the early 1900s. Instead, I was mesmerized by Celie's letters to God, as well as those between her and her sister Nettie, making it perhaps the first African-American epistolatory novel. This technique enabled Walker to create a closeness between herself and her readers. a trust that was essential for us to not only have empathy for Celie's struggle, but also believe that her journey to self and escape from violence was possible. Though I did not know that when I first read the book, I desperately needed Celie's healing as a salve to help me recover from my own experiences with sexual assault. And as I detailed in my own book, In Search of the Color Purple, The Story of an American Masterpiece, I repeatedly turned to the novel, as a teenager, then as a teacher, and now as a critic, again and again finding new meanings and models for my feminism. And now as I read her journals, I can see her own self-discovery informed her arc, and in turn, those of her beloved characters. Walker received her first journal, a travel diary, as a gift from her Spelman College classmate, Cecile Genpatzing, before Walker's trip to Europe, traveling by air and out of the country for the first time. The brown faux-leather daybook had a gold border and embossed lettering that read, "My Trip." During her time in Helsinki, Glasgow, Amsterdam, and Hamburg, the 18-year-old Walker, whose main journeys until this time were from her rural hometown of Eatonton, Georgia, to Atlanta, and once to visit family in Cleveland, wrote daily about her adventures and unknown to her at the time for posterity. At the end of the trip in late August 1962, she wrote, "Although I was only in Europe for about a month, I know that my life will be different because of it." Reflecting on the growing crisis between Russia, Cuba, and the United States, Walker confided, "Most of all, I've learned that there is so much difference between the people and their governments that one cannot any longer hate indiscriminately." Her epiphany was far-reaching, equally transforming Walker's worldview and her relationship to writing. From that time, and during her tenure as a student at the predominantly white college Sarah Lawrence, she also saw journaling as the unique exercise that helped her notoriously bad memory recall conversations, psychic discoveries, and journeys of all kinds. And it is this parallel life as a near-daily diarist and one of the most prolific writers of her generation that fascinates me. After a year of visiting her extensive archive at Emory University, made up of more than 250 boxes, and poring over her correspondences with friends and fans, and several drafts of stories and novels in preparation for my own work, I left in awe of Walker's sheer volume and strict discipline, starting with her first book, a volume of poetry called Once, in 1968. Her catalog now includes 7 novels, several short stories, 6 children's books, and volumes of essays and poetry, the last of which, Taking the Arrow Out of the Heart, appeared in bookstores in 2018. But even as I sat immersed in her papers, I knew that there were absences in the archive to which I had access. For while Walker had made many of her materials available to students and scholars like me, she originally intended to embargo her journals, some 65 volumes spanning 50 years, until her death, or until 2027 should she die earlier. But when Walker donated her papers to Emory University in 2007, the journals among them, Walker's friend Valerie Boyd, who died at age 58 earlier this year of cancer, broached the idea of publishing an abridged version of the diaries. Boyd and her graduate student assistants remain the only people to have had exclusive access to all the journals. On a practical level, this meant that I was unable to read the original version of the most memorable first lines of a novel of all time. "Dear God, I am 14 years old. I am crossed out. I have always been a good girl. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me." And so opens The Color Purple, a book that Walker began not as a typed manuscript, but as a series of journal entries in which she sketched out her characters, plot, and timeline, while also recalling dreams or conversations that served as inspiration for her storytelling. Because I knew of the journals, even meeting editor Valerie Boyd while we were both in the archives, I felt that I was likely missing important details about Walker and insights about her process and my own exploration of her novel. But through reading Gathering Blossoms Under Fire, I was able to discover another voice of Alice Walker, the private self that helps make her public persona and published writings possible. "I have lived constantly in another present, the present moment of creation," Walker writes in Postscript. Reflecting on her own rereading of these memories, she says, "While I was writing the journals, I was also writing in another realm, worlds that I discovered in my imagination, novels, poems, short stories, etc. This means this journal is, in many ways, my attempt to hold moments I had savored with friends and others as also unforgettable and dear." The big moments, for the most part, in Gathering Blossoms Under Fire, are the ones she shared with mother, Minnie Lou, née Grant, her ex-husband, the civil rights attorney, Mel Leventhal, their daughter and Walker's only child, Rebecca, Walker's long-term partner and a former editor of the journal The Black Scholar, Robert Allen, and her shorter romance with singer Tracy Chapman, as well as Walker's friendships with Langston Hughes, Gloria Steinem, and energy healer Zeely Duvichel. Edited by journalist Valerie Boyd, Walker's longtime friend and the author of the definitive biography Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston, the scope of the book, encompassing more than 30 years and 560 pages, is sweeping yet still intimate. An artist's coming-of-age narrative and culmination of her life's work. Yet somehow it's also much more. There is a seamlessness to the arc here. Boyd's editorial hand feels invisible, leaving us to jump from episode to episode as Walker herself likely experienced or was weighted down by. Her deepest and most difficult encounters are with Mother. I feel sometimes that my family and I could not be more strange to each other, she wrote in July 1977. And over the past several years, I felt it especially true of Mama and me. I don't know this new Minnie Lou. She seems a shell. Divided into four sections, marriage, movement, and Mississippi, the 1960s, the nature of this flower is to bloom, the 1970s, be nobody's darling, the 1980s, and you can't keep a good woman down, the 1990s. The book reveals the intricate details of Walker's marriage and divorce, her maternal ambivalence, her bisexuality, her anxiety about and aspirations for the reception of her work, her spiritual practices, and most unexpectedly, the sources of both her financial stressors and her eventual success. As such, Gathering Blossoms shows us Walker at her most vulnerable and unvarnished. Rather than reifying her as an icon, she appears fully human, enabling us to see her not as some elusive literary figure, but as she saw herself, flaws and all. Personal writing is, has always been a dangerous activity because it allows us the freedom to define everything on our own terms, opined critic Parsha Bell Scott in Life Notes, Personal Writings by Contemporary Black Women, her edited collection. For those seeking to defy culturally imposed negative identities, personal writing has offered avenues for resistance and recreation. Rather than spend much time reflecting on or debating the reception of her works, Walker's journals exist in almost parallel time. Her winning the Pulitzer Prize causes her to retreat. Hello, this is a very tired Alice Walker. If you are calling to congratulate me, thank you. If you are calling for an interview, I am all talked out, she wrote before recording that message for her answering machine. Likewise, the public backlash mounted against her for Steven Spielberg's adaptation of The Color Purple takes up little space here. Nation of Islam's Louis Farrakhan and film director Spike Lee harshly criticized the movie's depiction of black men. There were also boycotts and petitions against the film mounted by organizations such as Coalition Against Black Exploitation and the Hollywood Beverly Hills chapter of the NAACP. Many accused Walker of reproducing racist stereotypes and supporting the breakdown of black families with her depiction of Suge and Celie's lesbian relationship. The relentless and personal nature of these attacks surprised and devastated Walker. Part of her disappointment was caused by her own belief in the goodness of The Color Purple's characters and her own intimate and loving relationships with black men, among them her brothers, nephews, and partners such as Robert Allen, whom she first met when he was a student at Morehouse and she was at Spelman in the early 1960s, before transferring to Sarah Lawrence. In our journals, her complicated, passionate, and somewhat tumultuous 13-year-long relationship with Allen looms even larger than the movie. I suspect this is partly because Walker spent a considerable amount of time recounting that more public backlash against the film in her 1996 book, The Same River Twice, honoring a difficult, a meditation on life, spirit, art, and the making of the film The Color Purple, 10 years later. And rather than repeat the passages from her journals included there, Boyd takes us even deeper into Walker's psyche. On February 3, 1978, Walker reminisced, "When Robert and I sleep together, we sleep soundly. I hear nothing. Think of nothing. It is delicious." On January 17, 1979, she gushed, "Robert gives me walks, the moon, pens that write smoothly in pretty colors. He gives me breakfast, rides in the car, trips to visit the ocean, woods, sky. He gives me love that is as vulnerable as my own. By November 12, 1981, we slept together, held each other, but that's all. I explained my feelings of sexual deadness, that it is as his friend only that I am staying in his life. We both cried a lot, at least I think he cried, and I felt sad for us. Here, Walker acknowledges the cyclical nature of their love and loss, but also, in an early passage from this same entry, admits her fondness for women-loving women. In time, her admiration turns into her own form of self-actualization. I almost failed to write the most important thing, she mused on October 16, 1987. My growing awareness of the goddess, on a cosmic scale, one could think of it as the little woman behind the man, and my own lesbianism. I almost feel this is a case of everybody knowing I'm a lesbian but me. As surprising as this revelation might have been for Walker in real time, I appreciate it even more retrospectively. It is a reminder that she never limited her desire to be either sexually or politically free in her personal life, but also pulled from her own experiences, including lovers, when inventing characters such as writer-to-be protagonist Susanna Robinson and her lover Pauline from her 1998 novel By the Light of My Father's Smile. Some of my favorite sections of Gathering Blossoms Under Fire might be considered old-fashioned gossip. In 1977, Walker and poet June Jordan founded the Sisterhood in New York City, a collective to support fellow Black women writers, including Toni Morrison, Notsaki Shang, and Audre Lorde. They met regularly, workshopped ideas, and plotted how to reshape the predominantly white and male publishing industry, as well as the Black women's magazine Essence. But when Walker learned that Morrison had sold the paperback rights to Song of Solomon for the lofty sum of $300,000 in 1979, she admitted, "I've been looking inside myself to see how I feel about this. A little jealous? A little envious? Probably." Perhaps the most surprising aspect of her journals is how they doubled as an accounting ledger. Walker took copious notes on how much she was making, owed, in debt for, and needed to put a down payment on a house and make renovations on it, as well as the cost of her daughter Rebecca's school tuition. Her wealth is both a source of conflict, Tracy Chapman and she fought over how much she paid her staff in Mexico, and pride, as a daughter and granddaughter of Black sharecroppers, Walker's purchase of properties in New York City, San Francisco, Mexico, Philo, California, and most recently back home near Eatonton, felt like its own form of reparations. My fascination with owning houses, which is in a way against my nature, I don't innately like owning things, comes from the desire to make where I live beautiful, comfortable, a place where everything works, she writes. Because Gathering Blossoms Under Fire concludes at the end of the last century, it avoids Walker's more recent conflicts, such as the 2018 controversy in which she was accused of promoting anti-Semitic conspiracy writer David Icke in the By the Book column for the New York Times. Instead, it is a testament to the common in the daily, including her struggle with depression and loneliness, as well as to find a space and place to create. And it gives voice to Walker's lifelong search for peace within herself, for our planet, and with those she loved the most. Gathering Blossoms Under Fire is a workbook for artists, activists, and intellectuals, or as Boyd offers in the introduction, it is a primer for people of all ages who wish to live free lives. Though that was not her intention when she penned those words to herself, this has been Walker's result. And much as she did when she gave us Seeley's Arc to Self-Love, Walker has given us another Black woman's journey, hers, and yet another chance to enjoy the beauty of life itself. Our next article is titled, Finding the Real You. Embracing the most you version of you isn't always easy. It takes wisdom, practice, and above all, courage. In the pages that follow, meet women who dare to live a more genuine existence and let them inspire you to do the same. Call me what you will. Ada Calhoun learns there's nothing like a false name to help you be your real self. My legal surname, Shindal, is complex in Norwegian. People see the J and abandon all hope of ever learning to pronounce or spell it. It's a name I use only for appointments, plane tickets, and my license. It's also the name of a prominent writer, my father. Growing up, I wanted to be a writer myself, but I felt that job was taken. You're not related to the art critic, are you? People asked. If they gleaned that I had an interest in writing, they'd say, chip off the old block, eh? I hated that metaphor. He was a granite monolith, I a shard. He was leaving heavy footprints in the earth while I tiptoed behind. At 22, I was hired by the Austin Chronicle. As uncomfortable as I felt pursuing a writing career, I couldn't get a job anywhere else. As I filled out the new hire paperwork, I discovered a little box that read DBA, or Doing Business As. That space vibrated with potential. Sitting at this newspaper's office, I was edging onto my father's turf. But when I saw that box, I thought, who do I want to do business as? I wrote down Ada Calhoun. Calhoun is my middle name. I was born on St. Patrick's Day, so my parents named me after an Irish friend. How nice, said Betsy Calhoun Baker, but my name is Scottish. With my new designation, I felt reborn. Ada Calhoun had no past, only a future. She was her own person. She was confident. She dressed sexier. She said her name and people didn't ask her to spell it 10 times. It wasn't just a pen name, though it did help me feel freer in writing articles for the Chronicle and later elsewhere. I used the name socially, too. Most of my friends have no idea who Ada Shedall is. Ada Calhoun has existed now for 17 years, most of my adult life. I've been operating as two people for so long that I hardly notice the way a bilingual person switches between languages without thinking. I wrote a book about the street where my parents live. I dedicated it to them. And yet the title page bears my other name, the one I gave myself, the one without which I would never have written, the one that's all mine. The deafening silence. In third grade, a bully stole Nancy Johnson's voice. It took decades to find it again. Things had started off so well. I arrived in third grade with my pencil sharpened, my notebook waiting to be filled. I loved school. The dusty chalk, those tidy Scantron test bubbles, the chance to show what I knew. Maybe that's why, as I went to my seat after yet another trip to the blackboard, a girl I'll call Connie led a chanting chorus, E student, E student. At our school, E stood for excellent. To them, I was a goody-goody, trying too hard, doing too well. Heat flooded my face. I avoided Connie's gaze. She was like a bulldog, her body squat, her face pinched into a scowl. Soon she was mocking my afro, my glasses, my height. One day, the bell rang at the end of class. Outside, dandelions dotted the lawn. I still remember how blue the sky was. I took a shove to my back and fell. Connie's weight on me made me gasp. I tasted grass and dirt. I couldn't see. As I groped for my glasses, I heard a crowd laughing. After that, when my teacher called for volunteers to go to the blackboard, I lowered my head. I dreaded speaking, afraid I'd attract Connie's attention. You're not good enough, I thought. Why else would Connie have chosen me as her target? She was like an echo through my life. For years, I watched my sassy, self-possessed friends with envy. I became fascinated by news reporters. I mimicked ABC anchor Carol Simpson's authoritative voice and adored CBS's Charles Corralt with his folksy baritone. I wanted their confidence. But well into adulthood, in meetings and at dinners with friends, I kept mum, sitting frozen, unsure of when, if at all, to jump in. At a certain point, recovering my voice, the full, vibrant, throaty essence of it became my priority. It started as a game. Be the first one to speak in a meeting or offer an unpopular viewpoint in chats with friends. Sometimes Connie won out and I went mute. But more and more, I said what I had to say. Once at an open mic in front of a finger-snapping crowd, I recited a spoken word piece I'd written. Then I sang karaoke at a party. The more I used my voice, the better it felt and the easier it got. About 20 years ago, I went to my hometown to visit a relative in the hospital, and the receptionist greeted me kindly. I'll never know if my expression betrayed my horror. Probably not, because Connie kept right on smiling. All those years later, she didn't remember me. I often wondered what I'd do if I ever saw her again. Curse at her? Tell her she screwed up my life? I did none of those things. I didn't even tell Connie who I was. Instead, I smiled back. I had plenty to be happy about. Soon I'd drive home to Wisconsin and take my place at the anchor's desk or in the field, just like I did every night, to report on the news, My face and voice broadcast into thousands of homes every day. Don't quit your night job. A sensible office worker, a daring sword swallower. Spoiler alert, they both were Elise Carter. Though I owned tights and weapons, I wasn't a superhero. By day, I was Elise Carter, mild-mannered copywriter. By night, the Lady A, fire eater and sword swallower. After a lifetime of being obsessed with sideshows, I started performing in my 30s, appearing in variety shows, wearing corsets and tutus and cheap gowns like a low-rent Marlene Dietrich. My stage persona gave me confidence. If I got a laugh or pulled off a stunt, I cared less about the size of my hips or paycheck. But my night job didn't pay my New York City rent, so off to work I went, writing ads for ugly shoes and wrinkle creams. After work, I go home, dress, and paint myself, then head out to entertain amid the cocktails and seedy glamour. I'd get home late, sleep, then go to the office with its grim fluorescent lights and coffee that tasted like gym socks. Not wanting to be teased by my coworkers, I kept my moonlighting gig to myself. It gave me cold sweats to think of the button-down bros and sales finding out that I spent my nights in dive bars with tattooed half-naked people. It wasn't hard to keep my public appearances private, since my colleagues and I never talked much anyhow. In 3 years, no one asked me why I always came to work covered in glitter or why I sometimes toted a giant bag full of swords. I started to see why some superheroes seem so isolated. You do something amazing and want people to know, but you can't bring yourself to shout, "Hey, I'm actually kind of the Human Torch," but I wanted to be sweetheart of the sideshow, not the office weirdo. So I decided to go freelance and work for my private lair. I quit, and on my way out, I emailed a goodbye and the secret coordinates to Lady A's website. I got one email from a girl who thought it was cool and never heard from or saw any of them again. Still, I was happy to reveal my other life, and even happier to live it. Our next article is titled Alice Walker on Counting Her Financial Eggs. I had my first paying job when I was 7. My 2 older brothers and I were hired to pick daffodils for the wife of the man who owned the land our parents worked. In this part of middle Georgia, there are thousands of gigantic pecan trees, and it was under such trees that the 3 of us set to work. There were deep yellow and pale yellow daffodils, which our boss, in a strong southern accent, referred to as jonquils, almost as far as the eye could see. To a child, it seemed a fairyland, and I set to picking daffodils with delight. We were paid a nickel a bunch. Our boss lady sold them in town for a quarter a bunch, which we didn't know and didn't care about. And I proved to be a speedy and efficient picker. I might have earned as much as $0.50 each day. This went into a piggy bank that was shaped like an actual pig. My hardworking parents instilled in all their children early on that saving was to be a habit that would mean we could afford to buy presents for ourselves as well as for others at Christmas. A few years later, when I wanted desperately to learn to play the piano, my mother decided to let me have all the eggs laid by our chickens. I sold these to a market in town and was able to pay the 50 cents per lesson my teacher required. In winter, though, the hens laid less, and eventually I had to give this up. Not until 50 years later would I circle back to this dream, hire a piano teacher, and learn to play 6 songs, among them James Weldon Johnson's Lift Every Voice and Sing, commonly known as the Negro National Anthem, and Beethoven's Ode to Joy. Having learned these 6 songs, I promptly forgot how to play the piano, which is one of those mysterious happenings in life that make you wonder. But the egg experiment taught me something that put me at odds with the endless growth idea of classic capitalism and made me a budding socialist. I could see that the number of eggs required to fund my musical expansion was finite. I could also see that the eggs my passion for music was taking from my protein-deficient family would, in the end, undermine the health and stability of all of us. The experience taught me that I needed to develop a keener sense of planning and a deeper understanding of the means and reliability of production. One of my father's biggest dreams was to own a car. When my older brothers grew skilled enough to keep one running, my father bought one. It was not the little red sports car of his dreams, but it was roomy and rugged, and he could get almost all of his large family inside it. In this car, the 2 of us, when I was 13 or so, rode off to his lodge meetings, where I was designated secretary and took notes, or minutes as they were called. We also rode into town to visit the bank. If the family had accumulated even $10 above this month's expenses, into the passbook of the Farmers and Merchants Bank it went. Many years after I, the youngest, had left home, it was a joy to learn that my mother, who had always stayed home after getting everyone else dressed and ready to leave the house, learned to drive a car and at some point found her way to the ocean, which she had never seen. Not even bothering to take off her stockings, she plunged in as if she could swim. There is a wonderful photograph of her beaming and sopping wet as if she'd just met her own mother, and of course she had. But how clever it was of my father to take me with him to his boring, to me, lodge meetings, where I was to take down information that had zero meaning to me. I see it now as preparation for the writing life that has been mine since I was in my teens, and how positively resolute it was of him to take me with him to make deposits in the Farmers and Merchants Bank, the only unsegregated establishment in the county and the only place white people seemed almost happy to see him. I somehow developed, with the guidance of my parents and the love of my community, a sense that I could learn the mechanics of life, find work, do it well, enjoy it as much as possible, and use my earnings to support the yearnings that sprang, apparently, from my soul. Babysitting, waiting tables, and working as a salad girl at a local 4-H retreat for white youth all meant I could, by the time I was a junior in high school, take care of all my clothing, hair, health, and dental needs. This was fortunate because after raising 8 children, my parents were exhausted and struggling with their own health. Right up to my 40s, I made a monthly list of every purchase and every anticipated expense and measured it against what income I might expect to receive. I had a profound sense of my indebtedness to both my parents on the day that I knew I could single-handedly pay all my daughter's expenses as she went off to Yale. As a woman, I was always aware that unless I wanted to be someone else's dependent throughout my life, I must become myself, my own breadwinner and independent person, and that the freedom this assured meant I could speak my mind and share my thoughts and resources in any way I choose. A woman afraid to speak her mind is usually a woman who depends for her upkeep on someone else. This would have been intolerable for me, though I might have adored the person who kept me. Learning about money is as important, perhaps more important, than any other subject. I recommend finding a teacher or teachers who can help navigate the world of saving and of spending wisely. It is crucial that women have shelter, for instance, listed in their names. Otherwise, they and their children can be held hostage as they were for hundreds of years during which only the man owned the house, as by marriage he owned his children. If individual ownership is impossible, then by all means form collectives with other women that will allow for the acquiring of property together. This can strengthen one's own stability as well as ease the burden on everyone. I have not myself been able to do this, but it has always seemed to me to be both extremely logical as well as a way to foster well-being and community in a country rarely supportive of independence of this kind and magnitude. Attempt to find a system of saving and increasing one's wealth that is ethical in its concern for the planet and for other creatures, as well as humans. Witnessing school closures, widespread food anxiety and homelessness, and the lack of access to basic health care in our country and beyond, I'm reminded of what was important in my community and in my family as I was growing up. Learning how to earn money, how to use it for good purposes, and to save whatever you could of it in anticipation of one's most cherished desires. All with the understanding that if there is to be a future at all, it is best to be able to support it in a style that one wants rather than one that is imposed. Our next article by Julia Edelstein is titled, Why Haven't More Moms Returned to the Paid Workforce? Back in February 2020, Kate worked full-time running her practice as a clinical psychologist. She saw patients for therapy in an office Monday through Thursday, often clocking in at 8 a.m. and wrapping up long after dinner. Fridays were reserved for administrative work and billing. Though the hours were intense, the setup fulfilled her as both a mother and a professional. I was the mom who was so ecstatic when we found a nanny we loved and I could go back to work for maternity leave. The quality of the time I spent with my son was much better when I had a full-time working schedule. I could be more present and put all my work stuff to the side. If I don't have that work separation, I get stuck. I need that predictable division of here's my work self and here's my mom self. When the pandemic shut everything down in March 2020 and her son's caregiver could no longer travel to their apartment, Kate downshifted her career. It was survival mode, she says.
Her husband's company provided the family's health insurance, so quitting wasn't an option for him, though he did work flexibly to support Kate's part-time work. "I maintained this very weird working schedule," Kate recalls. "I was on duty with my son in the mornings and then would see patients for therapy during his nap windows or in the evenings. The constant role shifting, combined with the challenge of counseling people in a period of communal grief and uncertainty, exhausted Kate. Soon, she was so burned out that she had to drop her evening hours and worked only during naps. I could see patients or do notes or emails after my son goes to bed, but I don't. My mental bandwidth can't take it. I just need to disconnect," she says. Kate's ambition hasn't faded. She says that she still identifies as a clinical psychologist first and a mother second. Yet even though her son, age 3, has been in daycare for a year, she hasn't brought back the workload that she dropped in 2020. "I'm not done recovering from those 15 months without a caregiver. I still need more room to breathe and find my way," she says. There's no question that our society's failure to subsidize childcare, value caregivers, and provide paid family leave is the primary driver behind a well-known and devastating fact. Women left the workforce at twice the rate of men over the past 2 years. And while men have recouped just about every job lost between February 2020 and March 2022, the workforce is still short about 1.1 million female employees, according to an analysis of data conducted by the National Women's Law Center. In Motherly's 2022 State of Motherhood survey, released just weeks ago, nearly half of Gen Z and millennial moms who quit or left their jobs last year said problems with childcare were the cause. Burnout trails closely behind as a factor. A recent global survey called Women in the Workplace by the consulting firm McKinsey found that 42% of working women say they are burned out. 1 in 3 women has thought about leaving or downshifting their career in the past year. By contrast, when the same survey was fielded earlier in the pandemic, only 1 in 4 reported wanting to leave. In a new national survey released by the Ohio State University, 66% of working parents qualified as being in a state of paternal burnout. A defining feature of burnout is the sense that everything is meaningless, and no matter what solution or action I propose, it will be pointless, says Pooja Lakshman, MD, a psychiatrist specializing in women's mental health and the founder and CEO of Gemma. And the thing with burnout is that a good amount of this is coming from employers and systems where that might be true. When an organization has time and again shown you that they're not willing to support parents or people of color in ways that matter or make a substantial difference, leaving really might be the right answer, if you have that luxury. For many Americans, the situation is enraging and harrowing, and it's inspired some to shout from the rooftops that women need a better deal. We need social and political change so that you can take paid leave when you need to recover or care for your children. A lot of this energy needs to be directed at collective action, says Lakshman. Adds clinical psychologist Alexander Solomon, PhD, author of Loving Bravely and host of the podcast Reimagining Love, if we lived in a world that truly valued caregiving, then stepping away from paid employment would evoke pride, not shame. It would be viewed as one of many choices rather than as either a noble choice or an embarrassing choice. There are several organizations, including the Chamber of Mothers, of which Lakshman is a founder, leading the charge on this issue. But if you're ambitious yet burned out, or one of the 67% of women who dreams of quitting their job, it may also be helpful to remember that every one of the 1.1 million women still out of the workforce has their own story. The twists and turns they took on the road to a career pause are nuanced and personal and extend beyond a daycare center closing or a salaried position that barely covers the cost of childcare. Learning about others' experiences can provide a glimmer of insight as to what can happen to your identity, your worth, and your vision of the future if you have the privilege to choose to stop working. Privilege is a key word here. The privilege is not staying home or going to work, but having the choice, says Neha Roosh, the founder of Mother Untitled, a community and resource for ambitious women navigating a career pause or downshift. The stories of these women reveal the transformative power of taking drastic action that makes you feel better. The treatment for all this burnout is rest, and it's not restful to be taking care of kids, working full-time, and looking for a new job. From a mental health, self-focused perspective, the smart way to go about it is to stop, regroup, and evaluate what you want, says Kristen Drake, MD, a perinatal psychiatrist in New York City. While experts believe that many women will soon return to the paid labor force, particularly as childcare becomes more reliable, some women are very much on their own timeline. "I don't have a lot of answers yet, just questions," says Anne, who worked in technology in Atlanta until November 2021, when she could no longer ignore the feeling that she wasn't satisfied. Now that she's caring for her two young children full-time, she says she is relieved to no longer be distracted by Slack messages or thoughts of how to approach the next day's meetings and emails. But she also learned that full-time mothering is not the be-all and end-all for her. In her downtime, she has started to imagine a future in which she returns to the paid workforce. "I'm being intentional about not going back to the most obvious thing I was doing before. I'm thinking about how I want to spend my time and what returning to work will look like," she says. Over and over, women share that while their ambition remains, the urgency to continually feed it or to pursue it traditionally is weakened. In a pause or downshift, Ruch says there's an opportunity to exist in a gray area, to focus on time with your family, but also to network, volunteer, or work part-time. When women claim that in-between space, it gives them the ability to make the right choice for right now, knowing that they can reevaluate again and again. We'll end this week with the quote of the day from Oprah.com. "Sitting with myself and telling myself my whole story enabled me to be able to be truthful and purposeful." Janet Mock. Volunteer or work part-time. When women claim that in-between space, it gives them the ability to make the right choice for right now, knowing that they can reevaluate again and again. We'll end this week with the quote of the day from Oprah.com. "Sitting with myself and telling myself my whole story enabled me to be able to be truthful and purposeful." Janet Mock. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.